You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Hi, this is Karin Zissis with ASCUA Online. If you've been checking our site recently, you may know we've been covering Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO, and his first 100 days in office. You can see what's happened during his honeymoon period at as-coa.org/AMLO100.
Se va a ver un cambio verdadero. Ya inició la transformación de la vida pública del país.
López Obrador promised change, an actual transformation, no less. And his high levels of public support, along with the majority backing of his party Morena in both the federal and state legislatures, have meant big shifts already. But does he have a deadline before the public support runs out? Are there checks and balances in place? And how does López Obrador face them? What role does nostalgia play in this presidency? I delved into some of these questions with this episode's guest.
My name is Carlos Bravo Regidor. I'm an associate professor at CIDE, a public research center based on Mexico City. And I'm also the director of the journalism program here.
On top of his work at CIDE, Carlos is a commentator for a number of prominent Mexican radio and television programs, and he's a contributor for Reforma, Mexico.com, and New York Times en Español, among other publications. He studied international relations at El Colegio de México and history at the University of Chicago. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Your positive reviews help spread the word about this series, so please take a moment to share your views and subscribe. Thank you for joining us. First of all, thank you very much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
So AMLO's rounding out his first 100 days in office, and polls are showing him doing very well, with really strong support. But I noticed in an El Financiero poll from this week that 78% of people support him. But of those 78%, 52% back him for what he's done, and 47% back him for what they think he's going to do. So for me, that's a lot of people hoping that he's going to do what they want. Do you think there's a deadline by which AMLO has to deliver?
Well, I think it depends on what issue. I think that there are three great issues, that systematically show, being the priorities or where people are placing their highest expectations. These issues are, number one, insecurity, violence, crime, etc. Number two, the economy, growth, poverty, inequality. And number three, corruption. I think the horizons of each of these issues is different. So I think the one that's more important for AMLO to deliver quickly and where people's patience, so to speak, is going to run out faster is insecurity. There are basically three inputs for people to know about what's going on with insecurity. Number one, personal experience. Number two, media scandals. And number three, hard data. Mm-hmm. Those three inputs don't work the same way with the other issues. For instance, with the economy, the data is really not that important. Mm-hmm. People don't pay so much attention to that. What matters most is personal experience. And with corruption, what matters most is scandals, mm-hmm. corruption scandals. Hard data doesn't matter that much. And personal experience with corruption is always very relative. So I think the issue where most expectations are concentrated at this point and where people are expecting actually faster results is insecurity. I think it's no coincidence in that regard that López Obrador made the Guardia Nacional a top priority. I mean, this is, to start rolling out the policy that he wants to implement in order to try to reduce crime, insecurity, violence. I mean, he even changed his position. I mean, if you compare what he used to say in campaign to what he has done so far, there's clearly a shift. He's become much more comfortable with militarization, and he has even pushed for a constitutional reform to allow armed forces to carry out tasks of public security, which was actually explicitly prohibited in the Constitution. This will probably go to the court because the court said previously that it was unconstitutional for the armed forces to perform, public security police labor. So now we might end up seeing something that would be, very new, which is the court trying to decide if a constitutional reform is constitutional. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So this is very interesting legally, but it's also very disruptive, because for a lot of people that voted for AMLO because he offered something different. He offered a non-punitive approach, an approach much more focused on the social roots of violence. He hasn't quit in terms of that offer, but he has put the emphasis precisely on the punitive side, creating a new institution like the Guardia Nacional, which is basically a militarized police force to deal with this. So I think that, to go back to your previous question, it is insecurity and violence, the first stop, so to speak, where we are going to see, apart from the honeymoon, the electoral honeymoon that López Obrador still has with Mexican public opinion. When the results start kicking in, we'll see how preference of how approval of him goes up or down.
It's really interesting that note about that he promised something different, and yet we're going with the Guardia Nacional, the National Guard is how they translate it in English, of this more militaristic approach towards security. One thing that surprised me, knowing that and hearing so many people during the campaigns talk about we have to change this and violence, is that I'm surprised by how many people support the move. Why? I've noticed in approval polls and in polling that there seems to be support for this move, in spite of the fact that you see a lot of chatter online about why are we doing this? Why are we going this way? Why do you think there is so much support broadly among the Mexican public for this?
Well, it's interesting because people support the armed. I mean, the amount of people, and particularly the kind of people in terms of the demographics that support using the army for this sort of tasks are people that are generally very skeptical of institutions in general. Institutions have, political institutions in Mexico, as in the rest of the world. I mean, this is not something exclusively Mexican. Are under a lot of stress and are under a lot of stress and also have a credibility crisis. So the army comes in as an institution that people still want to believe in. It's interesting because if you ask questions with a more critical bent, people will tell you that, the army has also been corrupt, or the army has, committed human rights violations. But when you ask who do you trust to take care of security in Mexico, people will answer, in a big majority, the army. People trust the army better or more than they trust police forces. This has been a constant since Felipe Calderón decided, to launch this war against organized crime. His solution, using the military for this, was always very popular. Which is interesting because you can tell that when people, make insecurity their priority, it's because, certain policies have not worked well. Using the army to fight organized crime has not worked well. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the most important indicator of this, which is, the rate of homicides per 100,000 inhabitants, it's up to historical levels right now. So there's a disconnect between the expectation and the accumulated experience. We know, because we've been through this for 12 years. We've, you know, we've created knowledge of what works and what doesn't. And we know that using the army for this doesn't really work. You need institutions that have more local roots. You need police. You need to strengthen civil society. There are a lot of things that need to be done. That, you know, putting the emphasis on the punitive approach only creates more violence. So there's that. There's that accumulated knowledge. But, you know, somewhere else that's not connected to that, it's the social expectation that because López Obrador is different and he's honest and he really believes in this, that this time it will work. So there's experience on the one hand, and on the other hand, expectations.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's a couple of days ago, someone asked me, why is AMLO so popular, right? So because you're seeing in recent days in Mexico, there's been a lot of buzz around the fact that rating agencies are having a negative outlook for Mexico. You're seeing downgrades in terms of economic growth expectations. So in the middle of all of this, why is AMLO so popular? And one thing I find interesting is the way that he communicates. He has a daily press conference. On the weekends, he goes traveling throughout the country, meeting with people. Can you, especially as someone who is so focused on journalism, can you comment on how he communicates and how that makes him different maybe from other leaders, whether internationally or other Mexican leaders?
Okay, so let me break that down in two questions. Why is AMLO so popular and how he communicates? I mean, they are obviously connected, but let me tackle them separately. Mm-hmm. Regarding the first question, why is AMLO so popular? Well, first of all, I mean, there's a part of the phenomenon of his popularity that is very, you know, common or normal or expectable, which is the honeymoon period. He won by a landslide. He's been in power for 3 months, which is still very little. And, you know, there is this phenomenon has happened almost all the time in Mexico. When a president wins, he starts stronger than with a larger percentage of approval than the percentage of votes he got when he won. So that's normal. That's regular. If you look at Fox, for instance, you will see numbers more or less similar to the numbers that AMLO has right now. So that's like the, you know, your typical political science explanation, which is very anticlimactic. You know, this is normal honeymoon. You know, don't get too excited. Don't get too scared. This is normal. This is what happens.
And I think one interesting thing about the Fox comparison is that Fox broke 70 years of pre. So he was also a president who was about change, at least.
Yes, and a lot of expectations, of course. So I think one explanation is that, the honeymoon. But I think there are other elements. Another important element is the fact that the party system of the Mexican transition to democracy is in shambles. I mean, it had never happened before. I mean, in the short history of Mexican democracy, that voters would concentrate power as they did in this last election. One of the key features of Mexican democracy was that voters always voted for a divided government, you know, which meant the president's party had no majority in Congress. This, I mean, we were so used to this, you know, to the fact that there were no majorities. And even it was almost as if Mexican democracy was a minority democracy. There were never majorities because we are a very diverse country. We used to think that this was the way it was going to be from now on. And AMLO broke that. And I think he broke it not as a cause, but as a consequence. Because during the Peña Nieto administration, there was this thing called the Pacto por México, which was, you know, a series of agreement between the ruling party and the opposition parties, a series of agreements for pushing a modernization agenda, certain reforms that Peña Nieto was very interested in. And that made that really affected the opposition. That made the opposition, you know, it made it lose a lot of credibility as opposition. It looked at, you know, they're just supporting the government in exchange for nothing. And the only person, or the only movement that was really able to keep its credibility as opposition was López Obrador. So when push came to shove in 2018 and people wanted to punish not only the Peña Nieto government, which was very unpopular. You know, there were a lot of corruption scandals. The economy was very, you know, the performance of the economy was very mediocre. And, you know, violence levels went up again. People who wanted to punish Peña Nieto, but also to punish the parties that actually helped Peña Nieto govern, you know, had a very clear alternative. If you wanted to punish them, you voted for López Obrador. So I think that still today, López Obrador's approval or popularity is somehow an expression of the rejection against the Peña Nieto government and against the traditional party system that nowadays, because of the way Mexicans voted, is in shambles. And number three, and related to that, is the fact that, you know, even, I mean, that might explain, like what I just said might explain why you voted for López Obrador. But it doesn't necessarily explain why his approval right now is so high, given actually that he has made decisions that are very polemical, and that also, you know, make people worry about the results. Canceling the airport, you know, his energy policy, things that are going to deliver its fruits sooner or later. And those fruits might hit, you know, the people's pocketbook, their economy. But I think that he's still very high in terms of approval because people who voted for him have nowhere else to go. The opposition is so weak. There are no leaderships. There are no ideas, proposals, agendas, that even if you become skeptical or disenchanted with López Obrador, you have nowhere else to go. So that keeps his approval ratings very high. Now, regarding your second question, which also touches the first one, how he communicates, what he's doing differently, there is this sort of omnipresence of López Obrador these days. He has this device. You know, Donald Trump has his Twitter account. López Obrador doesn't use Twitter that much, but he uses, you know, something that is functionally equivalent, which is his morning press conferences.
Vamos a dedicar todo el tiempo posible a la sesión de preguntas y respuestas. Es mejor.
Every day at 6 o'clock in the morning, in the Mexican equivalent of the White House, which is the National Palace, you know, he's there to answer questions from reporters, to give, you know, messages, to have people from his cabinet, you know, take the mic and explain something or answer questions from reporters. So what happens is that through the day, what you see is, in Spanish, we call this the mañaneras, you know, the morning conferences. You see the mañaneras being repeated every day or reactions to them. So he has, you know, come up with a way of really controlling the conversation. And it's not only his voice and his message, but also, you know, it comes down to his face. He's the only one doing the talking, you know, or he decides who talks or he does or who doesn't. When reporters ask him questions, you know, sometimes he doesn't answer. You know, he answers something completely unrelated to the question that was posed. This has also been a challenge to journalists, and I think it has exhibited certain deficits and certain weaknesses of our journalistic profession in terms of following up or asking the tough questions or, you know, taking the president up to task and telling him you're not answering the question. But in general, this has created this sort of omnipresence of AMLO in public opinion, in the public conversation, that has translated into a narrative defeat of every other, you know, story or every other narrative in the public sphere. It's very hard nowadays, you know, to even be critical of AMLO because AMLO is so popular that criticism is very often interpreted as an attack, as you know, as coming from the political opposition. AMLO has done this thing, which is very worrisome, of, you know, somehow suggesting or openly saying that, you know, the press, and particularly the press that is critical to him, is like an opposition party. The distinction between criticism and opposition, or the distinction between checks and balances, institutional checks and balances, or informal checks and balances as the press, or as civil society organizations, or as autonomous organs, and opposition forces, you know, parties, is a distinction that we are coming back to over and over again to try to counter the tendency from López Obrador and from López Obradorista circles to represent all conflict as a conflict between the president and the opposition.
Mm-hmm. And you've written about this recently, about the idea of opposition and counterweights, right?
Yes, checks and balances, exactly.
And checks and balances.
Yes.
And I'm curious, do you see any institution that can serve as a counterweight? Because you just laid out something that the opposition is crushed, and mm-hmm. this is the way he's framing these checks and balances. Are there any checks and balances out there?
Yes. I mean, I put it this way. I said the opposition is very weak and is being unable to represent a check to the president's power. But the president is reacting to the checks and balances that still exist as if they were nothing else than opposition. Mm-hmm. An example of this is autonomous organs. You know, Mexico has had this weird legal historical trajectory where in the last 30 years we've created a lot of spaces of autonomy, you know, for organizations to carry out certain tasks that you would originally or you would normally have the government to do. Organize elections, set prices in energy, you know, administer, you know, transparency or access to information demands. All of that, we've decided to take it out of the sphere of government and create bureaucratic organizations to do that. That is a check and balance. I mean, because you want those decisions to be out of political reach. Particularly, you want those decisions not to be part of party everyday party politics. Of course, this has been a mixed bag. There are certain autonomous organizations that work better than others. And of course, these autonomous organizations are susceptible of being captured by economic powers or by political power as well. They are not immune to those sort of pressures. But López Obrador is treating them when he reaches like a restriction, when one of these organizations says, no, I don't agree with this. Or when it just happened recently, the head of the Energy Regulatory Commission, you know, made a criticism of the people. López Obrador was proposing commissioners for this commission, and the president of the commission made a very light, very reasonable criticism, saying, well, you know what, the profiles of the people that the president is proposing are more into oil than into electricity, and that's a problem for us because we regulate both markets. After that criticism, which was, you know, fair game, the president came out and fulminated this guy, saying, you know, this guy has a conflict of interest and I'm going to expose him. He reacted mediatically. He didn't take any legal measure. Mm-hmm. But mediatically, he signaled him, he attacked him. You know, it ended up with them having, you know, sort of powwow. They got together, they talked, and it seems that, you know, it's over now. But the president reacted to somebody who was embodying, in a way, you know, a counterweight, a check to his power, not as if he was doing his job, you know, which is to be an autonomous organization from the president's power, but as if he embodied political opposition. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are counterweights, there are checks and balances, but it is a problem that the president reacts to them, not understanding their institutional nature, their function in terms of, you know, how democracy works, but all the time represents them as spaces where the opposition is doing the work to undermine him. Mm-hmm. Or as places that have been captured by economic powers or that are corrupt. I mean, it's interesting to see how important the anti-corruption discourse was for López Obrador as a candidate. And now that he's president, he's using, you know, the grievance against corruption, not necessarily as a source for institutional reforms or for public policies, but as a weapon, as a political weapon. He's weaponizing anti-corruption to try to defeat his adversaries or to, you know, negotiate from a position of strength against, you know, his checks and balances. So I think checks and balances are doing what they can in this new context, but it's clear that the president doesn't like them. I mean, maybe he doesn't quite understand them. He doesn't like them, or maybe he's, you know, into this in school of thought that says, you know, those powers are not democratic. Nobody elected them. Mm-hmm. So they are a counter-democratic force that needs to be, you know, deactivated. If we are in a democracy and the president is supported by the majority of people, we really shouldn't have those organs. You know, that power must come back to the president, who is the source or the place where democratic legitimacy is placed. And I think this is very problematic because, you know, ironically, you know, a power that is limited, a power that is restricted, tends to be a much more efficient power. You know, limits strengthen in many ways. And if we start bringing all those powers back to the government, it's going to be a very heavy weight to carry. And I think that's going to have, if it happens, that will have consequences in terms of the government being able to meet all those new responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. So talking about the government having so much control over everything, one thing that's interesting is this week is also the 90th anniversary of the PRI, mm-hmm. right? And we have seen the PRI, which was the opposition party. Now it's the opposition party, but it was the party that controlled politics for decades in Mexico. And it's where López Obrador got his start, because it was the party. There wasn't some other party for him to get his start, right? If we see how many people now identify themselves as being PRIistas, it's plummeted.
Yeah.
Do you see Morena as the new PRI?
Yes and no. That's a comparison that has been thrown around a lot, because it seems that Morena in many ways is trying to become a new hegemonic party, trying to build a new hegemony. But I think there's a crucial difference with what used to be the PRI, you know, in comparison with what Morena can become. Number one, the country has changed a lot. The country is a lot more diverse and a lot more complex than it used to be. So it's really hard to imagine Morena just, you know, reconstructing the old PRI political system because of that diversity, because of that plurality, because integration, you know, with global forces, because of NAFTA or whatever comes in NAFTA's place. That renders it a lot more difficult. But also, because Morena has something that the PRI never had, which is democratic legitimacy. One of the soft spots or the weak spots of the PRI was always, you know, that its democratic legitimacy was in question. And that made the PRI a lot more susceptible, you know, for criticism or for opening spaces for the opposition. You know, the PRI knew deep down inside that was, you know, their original sin, so to speak. Morena doesn't have that original sin. So that renders Morena a lot more stronger, mm-hmm. because Morena doesn't have to give anything away to the opposition. We won, and we won by a landslide. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've become bullies, open bullies of the opposition in the way that the PRI never was. Of course, the PRI was a bully to opposition, but not so explicitly or so openly. You know, it was done on a much more, let us put this elegantly, discreet way. Mm. Morena has, you know, it's in open war with the opposition, even though the opposition is so weak. They want to cut, for instance, funding for political parties. They are conducting, you know, their business in Congress, for instance, as if the opposition almost didn't exist. They're breaking down, you know, certain customs or certain things that used to be done in one way or another, trying to accommodate for the diversity of forces in Congress. And no, we're majority, you know, we rule these chambers the way we want. So, yes, I understand why the PRI comes to mind when we look at the sort of hegemony that Morena seems to be trying to build. But I think we need to counter that, you know, that idea with the fact that the country is different and that democratic legitimacy also makes a lot of difference. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to you about the role of history, because you are also a historian.
Uh-huh.
And
I used to be one, at least.
Recovering historian.
Exactly.
and history is very important in all of the messaging as well, because this is the fourth transformation.
Transformación. Han habido tres grandes transformaciones en la historia de México. La independencia, la reforma, la revolución y nosotros estamos llevando a cabo la cuarta transformación de la vida pública de México.
AMLO has dubbed his presidency the fourth transformation of Mexico, with the first one being independence, then the building of the republic, then the revolution, and this is the fourth one. So we're talking about massive movements in Mexico's history, and he's putting it into that context. Mm-hmm. Can you explain how history, and I think to some degree there's a little bit of nostalgia, because he also talks a lot about this golden era, old days of the 60s. Can you talk about history and nostalgia as part of how he got
Yes, that's very, the politics of nostalgia in López Obrador are very important, because, you know, when he tries to position himself historically, his enemy is what he calls the neoliberal period. So what happened in Mexico between the 1980s and 2018? It's interesting because, yes, there was a neoliberal turn, and, you know, Mexico joined a lot of countries in Latin America, in the world, you know, in terms of adopting, you know, the recipes of the Washington Consensus, privatization, you know, all those sort of things. But, you know, that period was also the period when Mexico became a democracy. And AMLO doesn't make that distinction. For AMLO, democracy started with him. So that's kind of a bit worrisome. And, you know, his criticism of the priista system is very light in comparison with his criticism of the neoliberal period. I mean, AMLO joined politics. He was a priista since the late 1960s, and he left the PRI in the late 1980s. So he, I mean, and this must be put in context. Back then, if you wanted to join politics and you really wanted, you know, to get in the game, you needed to join the PRI. So he joined the PRI because that's what people used to do. And he was always part sort of the lefty wing of the PRI. And he left when that wing ended up breaking up with the PRI and forming the PRD. But, I mean, to come back to your question about history, it's very funny, because we're used to qualifying politicians, or to think about politicians in terms of, you know, how they're going to deliver, what their policies is. And López Obrador places himself in a different horizon. He doesn't want to be measured by his results. He wants to be measured in a historical perspective. I mean, he has this fantasy that he is going to be able to choose his place in posterity. This is a very megalomaniac signal, you know, because you don't get to do that. As the good old Karl Marx used to say, you know, men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. And López Obrador seems to think that because he's reconstructing the power of the presidency, he's going to be able to do that. And he places himself, you know, not in comparison with previous presidents, not with Peña, Calderón, Fox, Zedillo, Salinas. He wants to join, you know, like the big guns, Juárez, Madero, and Cárdenas. And this, I think this is very effective, because in a way, one thing that happened during the neoliberal period was the crisis of Mexico's national historical narrative. One thing that neoliberalism implied was that all that happened before was wrong. It was inefficient, it was corrupt, it was authoritarian, you know, so there was no more, you know, a sense of historical identity, of historical pride for a really long time in Mexico. You know, Mexico had to be made anew all over again. And what López Obrador is providing Mexicans with this sort of a nostalgia for the good old days, and by placing himself, you know, at the level of the historical big guns, is, you know, trying to recreate a national narrative, a national sense of being, a national sense of purpose, which has proved very successful in terms of political mobilization and in terms of capturing the imagination of a lot of Mexicans.
Very interesting. I want to talk a little bit about foreign policy. AMLO has made foreign policy far from the center of his focus. And one area that we've really seen this is the policy he's taken in terms of non-intervention with Venezuela. Mm-hmm. That's not an issue without controversy, seeing as Nicolás Maduro attended AMLO's inauguration. There's a lot of, you even hear comparisons of AMLO and Chávez and things like that. How do you see AMLO's return to this past policy? If we're going to talk about history, this is a past policy, Mexican policy of non-interventionism. And do you think that there could be anything that could happen, particularly in the case of Venezuela, that would shake this non-interventionist approach?
Well, it's very interesting because AMLO, you know, as I think as part of this, you know, politics of nostalgia, comes back to the idea that, you know, there used to be this principle of Mexico's foreign policy, which was non-intervention, respect for national sovereignty. And this is in Mexican foreign policy, this is called the Doctrina Estrada, which is, you know, because of the place that Mexico occupies in the international system, Mexico doesn't want to play the game of using recognition or unrecognition of governments as a political tool, because this was used against Mexico, you know, for a really long time. So they came up with this idea, this principle, this doctrine, the Estrada doctrine. But if you look at the actual history, you know, apart from the principle, if you look at the policy, the way the policy was implemented was very different. Mexico broke diplomatic relations with Spain, you know, after the Civil War. Mexico openly welcomed the Cuban Revolution in the late 1950s, early 60s. Mexico broke diplomatic relationships with Chile after the coup against Allende. Mexico intervened crucially in Central American civil wars, you know. So when you look at what actually happened, at the way in which that principle was applied, it's very different. Mexico did intervene. You know, people who do history of foreign policy will tell you, well, but that didn't really imply the violation of the doctrine. It implied a pragmatical interpretation of it. And what López Obrador is doing by saying, I want to recover this doctrine or this principle as a guide for our policy, is flattening it. When you look at what he says, that we shouldn't intervene, we should remain neutral and, you know, be faithful to the principle. And you look at the history and say, no, wait a second. Your interpretation is very, flat. That's not how we used to operate. I think that in a way he does this because he really believes something that he has said a lot of times, that the best foreign policy is domestic policy. I think he doesn't say that just to say, I think he really believes it. And he wants to stay out of trouble internationally, which is also a signal of something I was saying previously, of the fact that the idea that López Obrador has of Mexico and of the world is from a previous era. It's a much more simple world. It's a much less complex country than it is. But, you know, for the way things happened during Peña Nieto's administration, particularly in the moment of the 2018 election, that complex society that Mexico is today ended up voting for a guy that doesn't really reflect that complexity in his vision of the country, his vision of the world, or his policies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we can see that in relations with the United States. There were a lot of theories before AMLO was elected that he would have potentially a combative relationship with Donald Trump, but that really hasn't been the case at all. And while people wanted Peña Nieto mm-hmm. to stand up to Trump and accused him of not doing enough to stand up to Trump, there doesn't seem to be a push now for AMLO to do the same. And he doesn't seem to be losing any popularity by avoiding the issue. So why do you think that is?
Well, I think number one, the people, demanding Peña Nieto to stand up were López Obradoristas. So now they don't make the same sort of demand to their president. And number two, I think because, you know, López Obrador has realized that, you know, the best thing that he can do regarding Trump is try to stay out of trouble. Do not fall in his provocations. Just, you know, let him be. And as long as he doesn't messes with him, with his government, he'll just let him be, you know? Of course, this is problematic because, you know, Trump might not mess with López Obrador, but he's messing with Mexicans and he's messing with migrants Some of them Mexican, a lot of them Central America. But, I mean, this is not a way to solve a problem. What López Obrador is doing instead is just like trying to find an exit from the problem, which is don't engage. I think it's working, you know, in the short term and in a very shallow political sense. But I think this will have consequences. It's clear that there are points of conflict, that there are certain antagonisms where López Obrador and Trump, you know, don't see eye to eye. But I think López Obrador is systematically, you know, trying to, you know, push the ball forward, not to have to buy time. You know, because we know that Trump has a lot on his plate at the domestic level. And, you know, election is just around the corner. So, you know, just buy time. Don't get in a fight with him. We have nothing to win by fighting him. It's pragmatical, but at the same time, it's irresponsible because there are a lot of things that demand presidential attention, particularly regarding Mexicans in the U.S. You know, detentions and deportations. That's not something that the Mexican president can just, you know, remain silent about. But because Mexicans in the U.S. don't vote, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it doesn't matter politically to him. It's a cost that he's willing to absorb, you know, not to get into a fight that he doesn't want to get into.
Mm-hmm. I could ask you another 10 questions because this has been so fascinating, but I know you don't have a lot more time. So I want to ask you one last question.
Sure.
What has been the biggest surprise for you about the AMLO administration in this first 100 days that he's been in office? What's the thing that you didn't expect to happen?
I didn't expect his administration to be so right-wing as it has become. In terms of his security policy, militarization, in terms of you know, social or cultural issues, women, sexual minorities, vulnerable populations, you know, he has put up this new system of direct, unconditional cash transfers. You know, regarding many social problems, his solution is just throw money at it, which seems to me incredibly neoliberal in a way, you know, to shrink down the state and turn it into an ATM machine, basically. That's really against the grain of what I would have thought. I mean, I thought he was a leftist, a conservative leftist, very, you know, unique combination. But I somehow was aware of the fact that maybe in a country like Mexico, you know, what the left needed in order to win was to become conservative. But, you know, what I miss nowadays is not the conservatism, is what, you know, was supposed to be a leftist government. So regarding the militarization, regarding social policy, regarding the relationship with vulnerable populations, you know, minorities, women, I have this feeling that, you know, we ended up kicking the neoliberals out for a sort of new right disguised as a left. And it's very disquieting. It's such an intellectual challenge to make sense of. So that's, I mean, to put it, you know, very broadly, that's for me the most surprising aspect of his government, how right-wing it seems.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This podcast was produced by Luisa Lemmy. Check the podcast description notes for relevant links. The music in this episode was recorded at America Society in New York City. Find out about upcoming concerts at our 680 Park Ave headquarters at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thanks so much to all of you who have been writing us reviews. If you're new to this podcast and enjoyed it, please write us a review and subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or Stitcher.